Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast, and I'm so glad that you are with us today. One in three Americans gets less than 7 hours of sleep each night, according to a study released in February by the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. This was the first nationwide sleep study conducted via self-reporting. In addition to tabulating how many hours people reported sleeping, researchers gathered data about gender, age, race, education, and employment. So in this hour, we're going to talk about what impact can missing out on sleep have on your health. Seven is the number of hours recommended for adults. Getting less can put you at increased risk of obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, stroke, and other health problems. The CDC study found that many adults living in the southeastern region of the United States and the Appalachian Mountains reported being sleep deprived. Previous studies by the CDC found high rates of obesity and other chronic conditions in that same region. Our region. Ranking states, the CDC found Maryland is the third most sleep-deprived in the U.S. We'll also talk about who is missing out on sleep. People who reported they were unable to work or were unemployed got less sleep than people who were employed. Those with a college degree were more likely to have gotten 7 hours than those with less formal education. And we'll get some tips to help us give up bad sleep habits. Were you tapping away on your smartphone right before bed last night? With us today with insights on all these issues is Dr. Emerson Wickwire. Dr. Wickwire is an assistant professor of psychiatry and medicine at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and he directs the insomnia program at the University of Maryland Medical Center. Welcome to Midday.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm so glad you're here. I want to pick up on this idea of people bragging about not getting enough sleep, running on fumes as sort of a badge of honor. You have devoted your life to studying sleep. So what do you think when you hear that attitude?
Lack of awareness.
They just don't know.
They just don't know.
Forgive them for they know not what they do.
Forgive them for they know not what they do. That's exactly right.
Well, what is it primarily that they don't know?
Sleep is a central component not only to overall health and well-being, but to virtually every neurocognitive function. Sleep is has been referred to in the military as ammunition for your brain. So oftentimes the same reasons why we are curtailing our sleep, needing to do more work and feeling pressure to be more productive, missing that sleep actually undermines our ability to achieve our objectives.
Okay, but as a practical matter, I mean, thinking back to college, lots of all-nighters. And you might have told me, you'll do better on that test if you get a good night's sleep. But I'm looking at a whole set of notes I haven't reviewed versus sleep. And I really don't think I'm going to do better if I get more sleep than if I actually review those notes.
It's funny. It's one of the most common misperceptions, particularly amongst young people. There is a trade-off between short-term perceived benefits and long-term perceived benefits. So most of us tend to suffer from shiny object syndrome, and we're going to sort of pay attention to whatever is immediately in front of us. What we know, though, is that sleep, and I know we'll discuss this in a bit, is so directly related to learning that actually napping can improve performance even more than additional studying or additional physical practice, if we're talking about learning physical skills.
What is going on then during sleep that I'll do better on the test than if I study more?
Several things. The easiest way to understand it is that sleep is when neural networks are strengthened in the brain. So you've probably heard about the billions of bits of information that each of us processes each day. And it is actually during sleep when the irrelevant bits of information are discarded and the important bits of information are stored and solidified. So myelination, for example, which is what enables different regions of the brain to communicate with each other, takes place during sleep. If you do not sleep, that will not happen. It certainly won't happen effectively. And that's when you start to experience cognitive complaints downstream.
I want to ask what you mean by cognitive complaints, but first I want to understand. You laid out two things. You talked about irrelevant bits of information get discarded, important bits get solidified. Which doesn't happen if I don't get enough sleep?
Well,
am I just keeping too much that I can't organize, or am I losing important stuff?
Both, because the resources that we want dedicated to important information, let's say, important communication between centers of the brain doesn't happen. It's dissipated across this huge mass of information. So we know that we're not able to retain information very clearly from a number of dozens and even hundreds of experimental studies. We know that we're not able to retain information, that the brain simply isn't able to function properly with inadequate sleep.
And how inadequate? I mean, is shaving off a half hour or an hour enough to make a difference?
It's a very good question. I know one of the things we'll talk about is, can we make up for lost sleep on the weekends? And there is a difference between short-term sleep loss and long-term cumulative sleep loss. For example, all of the experimental scientific research looking at the effects of truncating sleep opportunity. So to put that in practical terms for our viewers and our listeners, when we study people, and we really study in a very detailed way what happens at a physiologic level in the body on sleep deprivation, these are always short-term studies. It would be virtually impossible from a practical standpoint and potentially unethical to sleep deprive people, let's say, for months on end. But we can sleep deprive people for several days, even up to 2 weeks. And what we see is that this is, again, I know we'll talk about it in more detail, the body's physiology flies off the rails. And these are really how we hypothesize that disturbed sleep changes hormone levels, it changes various neurotransmitter production in the brain, leading to some of the consequences that you mentioned earlier.
You keep promising we're going to talk more about stuff, and I'm trying madly to remember, apparently a function of not having had enough sleep. The question you just posed, can we make it up on the weekends?
In the short term, the answer is no. The long term answer is we don't know how long it takes to make up for lost sleep. In the early 2000s, there were several very well done studies looking at exactly this issue. What happens to the way our brain functions when we don't get enough sleep? So two studies were done at almost exactly the same time in two different major research labs here in the United States. And what you saw over consecutive days with the same amount of sleep, so some participants slept for 4 hours, some slept for 6 hours, some slept for 8 hours. And the differences between those groups got bigger and bigger over time. In other words, the effects of not getting enough sleep were both acute and cumulative. Now, in one of these studies, they did something very clever, which was to allow participants 3 days of recovery sleep. So you were mild, moderately, or severely sleep deprived for a week, and every day we put you through an intense battery of neurocognitive tests to measure memory and learning aptitude and response speed. After that week, after those 5 nights, you were given 3 days to sort of sleep it off. And then you were retested.
And let me just make sure I understand. Sleep it off meaning sleep as long as you want.
8 hours per night. So everyone was allowed to receive much more sleep over those 3 days.
But not unlimited.
Okay. Not in this study. That's correct.
Okay.
So then they're tested after 3 days, and they are still much worse off than they were at day one.
So they don't make it up.
They don't.
And has anybody looked at what happens if, you know, they change their whole lifestyle and they go from a position of being sleep deprived to multiple days of sleeping a good amount?
That research is currently being done by our neighbors in Silver Spring at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, looking at the needs for long-term recuperation from chronic sleep debt. Now, you can imagine why the Army is particularly interested in the relationship between sleep and human performance, because we're sending soldiers into high-pressure, low-sleep environments with very, very high stakes, including death of ourselves and others. So much of the research looking at sleep and human performance has been conducted by the Army. Now, although we do not know how long it takes to recuperate from long-term chronic sleep loss, we do know that prophylactically sleep banking can reduce the negative effects of sleep loss. In other words, if you know that you will be entering a period of high stress, high productivity, high work demands, a period when you are unlikely to get as much sleep as you need, you can sleep in advance, and that will mitigate.
You're kidding.
Nope, absolutely true.
Except, of course, looking at a period of high stress is probably exactly when I'm not going to sleep very well.
Well, let me give you an example. I saw a patient yesterday who has made tremendous progress in terms of treating his sleep disorder, and now he's very concerned because he's going to be flying to Europe for 2 weeks. And so he's concerned about extensive air travel and early morning awakenings and et cetera, et cetera. So one thing that we can do to mitigate the effects of jet lag is to make sure that we are really very well slept before we even get on the plane.
That is Dr. Emerson Wickwire of the University of Maryland Medical Center here on Midday on WYPR. I'm sure you have lots of questions for him. Do you have trouble falling asleep? Do you think you have a sleep debt? Have you done anything to address it, and how did that work? Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. I'm stuck on the sleep debt question. Essentially, you're saying I can get ahead of it if I see it coming, but I can't really fix it after I've incurred a sleep debt.
What I'm saying is that we don't know how long it takes to fix it, and almost certainly it takes much longer than most people think. In other words, to return to the college example that you mentioned earlier, I pull an all-nighter to cram for a test, and then I'm going to go home. Does that nap help me? It absolutely helps me, but does it return me to the way I was before that all-nighter? No.
I'm a ruined woman. I have pulled so many all-nighters. Let's just get clear on how much we need. I said 7 hours. That seems to be a standard applied to adults. Do we need less as we age?
That's a good question, and there is controversy in the scientific literature. Cumulatively, we tend to need the same amount of sleep per 24-hour period even as we age. However, as we age, we're also taking more medications, which can negatively impact sleep, and we're also suffering more chronic health conditions, whether those are cardiovascular conditions or metabolic conditions, heart disease, diabetes, et cetera, or even things like chronic pain or arthritis. All of those can disrupt sleep. We've talked a great deal about quantity of sleep, which is, of course, the first question that people ask. How much sleep do I need? And we have, when we see patients in clinic, I have an approach for identifying each patient's unique sleep number, because there is some variability across individuals. But a second issue, which you're now raising, has to do with sleep quality. In other words, it's not just the quantity of sleep, but it's also the quality of sleep. And very, very clearly, we know that quality of sleep changes as we age.
We have to take a quick break. Let's pick up on that when we come back. We'll be back with Dr. Emerson Wickwire of the University of Maryland Medical Center. We'll talk about insomnia and common sleep problems, and we'll take your questions. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. What does lack of sleep do to the body? Besides making you grumpy, it can lead to a mental fogginess that some researchers have said is similar to being drunk. And watch out if you're on the road. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration estimates that drowsy driving was responsible for 72,000 crashes and 800 deaths in 2013. We're talking today about sleep, why it's so important, and what to do if you're not getting enough. My guest is Dr. Emerson Wickwire, an assistant professor of psychiatry and medicine at the University of Maryland School of Medicine and director of the Insomnia Program at the University of Maryland Medical Center. You were talking about the quality of sleep being, I think you said, as important as the quantity.
It is, and many would argue that sleep quality is actually more important than sleep quantity. There have been several pioneering studies conducted, for example, at Johns Hopkins Bayview in the research laboratory where I completed my postdoctoral fellowship training, looking at pain sensitivity and sleep quality, and at least in healthy women who are at high risk for developing chronic pain conditions, we know that less sleep but higher quality sleep is associated with improved cognitive performance, less risk for depression, and less pain sensitivity.
What do you mean by higher quality?
In this particular study, what happened was that One group of women was allowed to sleep for four consecutive hours, which is sleep loss, there's no question, but at least it was four consecutive hours of high-quality sleep. And another group of women was allowed to sleep for 4 hours spread out over eight. In other words, these women would fall asleep, and then they would be awoken throughout the night. It would sort of resemble what we might consider chronic insomnia or sleep fragmentation or poor quality sleep, in other words, a clinical sleep disorder. And then the next day, they were tested in a number of different domains, as I mentioned, and very, very clearly consolidated high quality sleep is associated with much greater restorative function than fragmented sleep.
Okay, I mean, I get that literally interrupted sleep, but if two people are in your lab or are lying there asleep, how could you judge that one is having higher quality sleep than the other, as long as they're not being interrupted?
It's a good question. In healthy individuals, we would tend to ask them how they feel the next day, and we would associate sleep quality with restorative function. There are a number of medical conditions, primarily obstructive sleep apnea, chronic insomnia, and some others that we can talk about. Perhaps we'll be asked about them from your listeners, that can all decrease sleep quality. So the brain doesn't work like a light switch. In other words, if I walked across the studio and pushed that little button that you and I can see but our listeners can't, the lights would go out. Mm-hmm. And that's not how sleep works. Different parts of the brain can be more or less awake or asleep. For example, in early studies looking at the relationship between sleep and pain, and this was almost 100 years ago, researchers would administer tones during sleep. And those tones, remember, different parts of the brain can be more or less awake or asleep. So those tones would activate the regions of the brain that pay attention to listening. Now, the next day, the participants in these studies had no idea that their sleep had been fragmented or poor quality. They thought that they slept through the night because the majority of their brain was asleep. But then when they were tested for pain sensitivity, it was evident they had not slept well at all. So that's just one example for how sleep quality can be negatively impacted even when we're not aware of it.
Wow. Lots of people want to be part of this conversation. Let's go to Kathy in Columbia. Kathy, welcome to Midday.
Hi, how are you?
Just great. Your question?
I've been listening to the doctor citing direct evidence of all the negative effects on the cognitive abilities when subjects are sleep deprived, and I was wondering his opinion, his thoughts on the crazy schedules that surgical residents, need to be ready for when they're getting ready to become surgeons and doctors.
Kathy, I appreciate the call. And before I let Dr. Wickwire answer it, I also want to pull Susie into this conversation. Susie is calling us from Iamsville. Susie, welcome to Midday.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have worked 17 years as a night nurse, just like two times a week. But while I raised my boys, I was working nights. And I have severe memory loss from those years. I mean, you know, my kids would say, oh, we saw this movie. And I'd be like, I never saw this movie. So things happened during those years that I don't remember. And now that they're up and out and I'm a little older, I'm still having a very hard time getting quality sleep. And I don't know if now it's a factor of hormones or my age. Now that, you know, my youth is gone and I can actually sleep because I don't have kids at home. So.
And now you find it hard to. Susie, I appreciate the call. Can you address both Kathy talking about the strain we put on, she's particularly talking about surgical residents, but medical trainees in general, and Susie's experience working the night shift as a nurse?
I'd be happy to. Both of these questions involve the timing of sleep. So when we think about sleep, when we measure sleep, when we describe sleep, we talk about sleep quantity, which we've discussed, sleep quality, which we are starting to discuss, and sleep timing. Sleep is governed by two interrelated processes in the brain. One is called the sleep drive, or sometimes process S. This is just like hunger or thirst. It increases the longer that you are awake. If you're out running a marathon, you will build up more sleep drive than if you are watching television at home on the couch. Now, that is a linear function. In other words, it goes up over time. There is a nonlinear function called the circadian rhythm. You've heard of carpe diem, seize the day. This is circa diem, about a day, that governs every endocrine or hormone-related function in the body. So not only sleep and wakefulness, but also appetite regulation and sex drive and learning aptitude and memory formation. This functions on about a 24.2-hour cycle. These are hardwired, whether you like it or not, this is the way that your brain works. So when we talk about things like shift work, which I have a particular interest in, and I see many patients who suffer from current or past shift work disorder, or when we talk about medical residents and so forth, and transportation and highly sleep-sensitive industries, we need to be remembering that there is a sleep quantity factor and there is a sleep timing factor. Okay. Sheila, earlier you mentioned drowsy driving. This year, the Maryland Sleep Society is exploring possibilities, looking at legislation related to drowsy driving in our state, because the drowsy driving laws are particularly bad in Maryland. The National Sleep Foundation has just released a consensus statement parallel to the sleep need consensus statement. I was part of that panel looking at drowsy driving, and a panel of experts, including myself, concluded if you have slept less than 2 hours, you are unfit to operate a motor vehicle. How does this relate to the questions regarding medical residents? After 24 hours, the number of fatal medical errors committed by physicians increases 400% after 24 hours of sustained wakefulness, in other words, being on duty.
Four times as likely to make a mistake.
A fatal mistake. Now, within the past decade, work residency hours were regulated in some of your listeners will be aware of that, to reduce these sleep-related accidents. Not only are patients at risk, but physicians are also at risk, because after they've been on call 24 hours, they now have to drive home. The last point that I'll make in regard to your history of shift work, there is evidence that even long after I stop working shifts, I continue to experience sleep difficulties related to the shift work that I did earlier in my life. Now, there are these are clinical expert opinions rather than scientific facts, but based on my experience, and I've worked with hundreds of shift workers, and based on the best available evidence, it is a minority of individuals who can successfully adjust to long-term chronic shift work. It gets more difficult as we age.
That's Dr. Emerson Wickwire, head of the Insomnia Program at the University of Maryland Medical Center, here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. You can be part of this conversation. Lots of people want to be. Our phone number is 410-662-8780. Our email address is midday@wypr.org. Before I take Jason's call, I just want to follow up, though. Susie had raised that now that she's not on shift work, having trouble sleeping, and she said maybe it's because I'm older. She raised several factors, and you seem to say maybe part of it is also the residue of the shift work that she was on.
No question. There's no question.
Jason from Baltimore, welcome to Midday.
Hi. Two quick ones. A lot's been written about obstructive sleep apnea, snoring and all. I have central sleep apnea. I don't snore. Nobody's ever heard it, but I do stop breathing in the middle of sleeping. Could you please discuss that some, what causes it, what can be done about it? And the second thing is medicines, sleep medicines like Ambien, Xanax, how do they affect sleep?
Thank you, Jason.
Let's take those one at a time. Sleep apnea comes from the Greek apnea, which literally means no breath or no air. There are two forms of sleep apnea, as the caller mentioned. The most common form by far is what's called obstructive sleep apnea, where there is not enough space in the upper airway for air to get through during sleep. This is an obvious This has obvious and strong negative impacts on sleep quality because your brain is partially suffocating throughout the night. In addition to obstructive sleep apnea, where the air can't make it through, there is a disorder called central sleep apnea, which represents roughly 5% of sleep apnea. They can coexist, and when patients have both obstructive sleep apnea and central sleep apnea, it's called complex sleep apnea. In central sleep apnea, the brain does not send a signal to the breathing muscles. It's a little bit more detailed than I think we need to get on the call for why that doesn't take place, but it likely has to do with blood gas exchange. So the brain is not recognizing that I need to blow off carbon dioxide, and so patients simply do not breathe.
Just don't feel the need. And so how is that addressed?
It's actually treated the same way in most cases, using what's called positive airway pressure. This is a gentle, comfortable mask. It blows soft, typically humidified and mildly warmed air in and inflates the upper airway just like a splint.
And then Jason also asked us about sleep medicines. We had an earlier caller who couldn't stay with us who said, when do you know whether a sleeping pill is a good idea?
That's a big topic. The first thing that I'll say is that no pill can teach your body how to sleep. So if you have been having sleep difficulty lasting weeks, months, or years, it is incredibly unlikely that ongoing use of a sleep medication is the ideal solution. Sleep medications are associated with a number of risks and adverse side effects, particularly as we age. Now, that being said, there are a number of FDA-approved medications. It doesn't make you weak or foolish to try and take them, but I would encourage you to talk with an expert regarding why you're taking that particular medication, for how long you're going to take that particular medication, and which is the right medication for you.
Talk to an expert. You mean your family doctor, or who do you have in mind?
Family doctors are the, in many ways, the heart of the American medical system. They have incredibly broad expertise and relationships with specialist providers, and they know how to point in the right direction for problems that exceed their expertise. That being said, doctors don't ask about sleep, and patients don't tell about sleep. So 80 to 90% of the 70 million Americans with chronic sleep problems aren't ever treated. If you have a particularly sleep-savvy general practitioner, by all means, you can talk to them about it. They're all licensed to write the medications. But I would caution that it's not just quite that easy to have a prescription written and the problem solved.
Shay is calling us from Baltimore. Shay, welcome to Midday.
Hi, Sheila. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
What I'd like to ask the doctor about is children. And the lack of exposure to being outside and the amount of homework that children have to do, and they're just sitting in one spot for hours on end. And I know that in my daughter, who's 14, that is really affecting her sleep. And we also know that before a big test, they send out a pamphlet that says, get plenty of sleep, eat, and don't worry about the test. Now, I really feel like the educational system is setting our children up for so many chronic illnesses because of the amount of time that they're just sitting in front of their desk, in front of the computer, and they're not exercising. They're not doing all of these things that really contribute to being able to get a good night's sleep.
Shay, let me see what Dr. Wickwire has to say about it. Thanks for the question.
I think that the importance of sleep throughout the lifespan, particularly when we're talking about young people, cannot be overstated. This is when the brain is developing, and this is why, Sheila, the National Sleep Foundation and American Academy of Sleep Medicine recommended sleep duration guidelines that you mentioned earlier indicate a need for more sleep in teenagers. So when I was a boy and we were in gym class, we had the food pyramid and the presidential fitness test, and my hope is that that my son, when he is in gym class, they'll also be talking about sleep as a third pillar for health in addition to diet and exercise. Now, the second issue that you raised is one having to do with sleep and learning, and I think that we'll talk about that more as we move forward.
Okay, that we'll pick that up when we come back from this short break. We're talking about sleep with Dr. Emerson Wickwire of the University of Maryland Medical Center. He heads the insomnia program there. You can join this conversation with an email to midday@wypr.org or by calling us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. Do you feel well-rested? If not, you're not alone. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimate that about 1 in 3 Americans, or 83 million adults, are sleep-deprived. And here to answer your questions is sleep expert and director of the Insomnia Program at the University of Maryland Medical Center, Dr. Emerson Wickwire. We were talking about memory, the effect of sleep on memory, or sleep deprivation.
In 2006, there was a study published that had been conducted at Harvard Medical School, and the participants in this study were, perhaps not surprisingly, very bright Harvard undergraduates. And what participants were asked to do, they were given a list of words to memorize, and everyone got the list and was asked to regurgitate as many of the words that they had read as they could. Now, half of the group goes into the blue room and half of the group goes into the green room. And those in the blue room are told, we'll see you back here tomorrow. Just go ahead and live your normal life. And those that go into the green room are told, we don't want you to drive. We want you to be safe, but we want you to do your best to pull an all-nighter. Do your best to stay awake in safe and controlled circumstances, and we'll see you back here tomorrow. So the next day, everyone returned, and unbeknownst to them, they were asked, hey, you remember that list from yesterday? How many of those words do you remember now? Well, because this is a show about sleep, you might not be surprised that the group that stayed up all night didn't remember nearly as many words from the list that they'd seen 24 to 48 hours before. The genius investigator in this particular study, unbeknownst to the participants, had nested different kinds of words. So there were neutral words, car, tree, door. There were positive words, joy, love, happiness, and there were negative words, anger, sorrow, frustration. And the differences between these two groups were entirely due to the positive words. In other words, the participants who had stayed up all night couldn't remember happiness. So this is one reason why, if you've ever had a really lousy night's sleep and feel pretty cranky or irritable in the morning, or if you've been in a period of particularly high stress and your family or friends notice that things seem to be under your skin, it's because it's impossible or at least more difficult for your brain to focus on the positive.
That's fascinating. Julie is calling us from Baltimore. Julie, welcome to Midday.
Hello?
Julie, you're on the air.
Yes. My comment is that you can train yourself to go to sleep at night, but the only thing you have to do is you don't read in bed, you don't watch television in bed, you don't listen to the radio as you fall asleep, you have no noise. And if you wake up during the night, you also don't open your eyes. You keep your eyes shut. You know you're awake, but you keep your eyes shut. And one thing that I did was to get myself to go to sleep, I would imagine myself in a boat on the waves, and as I inhaled, I would come to the top of a wave, and as I exhaled, I would be in the trough. And gradually, as I fell asleep, I would disappear.
Interesting, Julie. I appreciate the call. What's your reaction to Julie's plan for falling asleep?
Julie, I think you have a future as a sleep medicine professional. Julie raised a lot of good points and actually offered a number of good tips for other listeners. I'd never heard of the image of riding a wave on the boats in that way.
Inhale, exhale, up and down. Yeah.
The importance of a pre-sleep routine really can't be overestimated. Sheila, earlier you'd asked about how I stumbled into sleep medicine, and that was through training to be a sports psychologist. I was interested in leadership and executive peak performance and working with high-level athletes. And I ended up in a sleep disorder center. This was 13 years ago, and it took about 20 minutes to realize what a wonderful synergy there was between sports and sleep. And one of the synergies that I built on was the idea of building a pre-sleep routine. In fact, I piloted and tested an intervention for insomnia called the pre-sleep routine. What I would encourage our listeners to think about is dusk. When the sun starts to set, it doesn't run back downstairs to check email. And we should build dusk into our days that represents a gradual descent from busy day into a transition phase and ultimately descending into, hopefully, deep, restful sleep.
So be specific about how that routine works. You said you don't do a last check of email. But Julie's routine struck me as really intimidating. As I recall, she said no TV, no radio, no reading in bed. Is that what we need to do?
Not necessarily. It sounds like Juliet had trouble sleeping in the past and found an approach that worked for her, mm-hmm. which I think is great. I see patients all the time who've been reading in bed for decades, and if they're having trouble falling asleep, oftentimes we do recommend that patients no longer read in bed. And they'll say, well, this has worked for decades. And I'll say, well, you didn't have problems sleeping until now. So in terms of creating a pre-sleep routine, I'm going to share, if I may, with our listeners, 7 steps.
Okay.
First, create a sacred space for sleep. If you wouldn't be texting or watching Game of Thrones in your church, synagogue, or mosque, you shouldn't be doing it in your bedroom. Next, work backward and think dusk. So we are going to create a ritual to enter that sacred space. Third, employ the stair step method so that you are winding down sequentially. For example, potentially when you leave the office, I'm going to write my to-do list for tomorrow and not think about it again until I get to the office tomorrow morning. At each step in the stair step, I'm going to discard a waking activity. For example, I might change out of my work clothes 2 hours before I power down all of my mobile devices. Fifth, make each step pleasant. So include a pleasant activity so that you enjoy each of these phases of your day. Finally, focus on three things for which you are grateful. You can write those in your pre-sleep journal.
Pre-sleep journal.
Pre-sleep journal. I encourage all of my patients to keep a pre-sleep journal where we are going to get the thoughts, worries, concerns out of our head onto the page and focus on those things for which we are grateful. It is about positive sleep.
We got an email from Maria. Who says, I've struggled with sleep since menopause. I now take 5 milligrams of melatonin every night and sleep deeply. Is this a quality sleep, and is this harmful over a long period?
There were two questions that I heard. One has to do with changes in sleep related to menopause. There are unquestionably changes that follow menopause. Many women experience menopausal and postmenopausal women experience fragmented sleep. In part, if you're going through menopause, it might be due to hot flashes. As hormones change for women, the patency of the upper airway changes. In other words, the tissues in the back of the upper airway become more and more collapsible. So whereas in younger adults, obstructive sleep apnea appears to be much more common in men, after menopause, those rates really balance out. So women suffer more obstructive sleep apnea following menopause. The second aspect of the question had to do with melatonin. Melatonin is a natural hormone. It's produced by the pineal gland. It is not a sleeping pill, but it tells our body it is dark outside. Now, at high doses, as the caller is taking 5 milligrams, I'd consider that a moderately high dose. And if you buy it over the counter, you'll buy it in 3, 5, or 10 milligrams. That's why everyone takes it this way. It will make you sleepy. However, a much more effective use for melatonin is as a circadian regulator. In other words, as a sleep timing hormone, not so much as a sleeping pill.
So, but what does that mean in terms of you just take it at a different time of day? And wouldn't it make you sleepy if you take it at a different time of day?
For most people, melatonin is not the answer to their sleeping problems. We do not recommend melatonin for general poor sleep quality kinds of issues, even though most people are taking it that way. What we do use melatonin for is to help with sleep timing, jet lag, shift work, what are called circadian rhythm sleep disorders. For example, we had a caller earlier with a 14-year-old daughter. My guess would be that her daughter likes to stay up late and would prefer to sleep in until noon. We can use melatonin at very low doses, perhaps 0.25, a quarter of a milligram, not 3, 5, or 10 milligrams, taken 4.5 hours before bed. The last comment that I'd make on melatonin is that it's not regulated by the Food and Drug Administration. And we've all seen plenty of headlines recently about buying supplements that actually were really nothing more than sugar pills.
So you can't actually be sure often that you're getting the melatonin you think you are.
In the United States, there's a pharmaceutical grade company that will only sell melatonin to researchers. There is in Germany a source for pharmaceutical grade melatonin that folks can order via airmail.
Ellen is calling us from Baltimore. Eleanor, we have just a few minutes left. Can you sort of summarize your point?
Yes. My husband suffers from a chronic illness of Crohn's, which is a very, very painful illness, and you don't know when it's going to occur. When it's really painful, the only thing that helps is a prescribed opium pill suppository, and that drugs him out. It puts him to sleep. It takes an edge off the pain, but his sleeping is so erratic because of the pain. With the drug, he'll be drugged out. Without it, he has interrupted sleep or no sleep at night, and so he sleeps all day. So I am wondering how his sleep pattern can get straightened out, you know, when you have chronic pain. And then I wanted some practical questions. One is working with you, remunerated by insurance.
Ellen, thank you for those questions. Let me make sure that Dr. Wickwire has time to answer those.
Yes, at the University of Maryland Medical Center, we accept virtually all major insurances and probably most minor insurances, too. To schedule an appointment, you should call 410-706-4771.
That's we will put that on our website, 410-706-4771. We'll put that on our website. Her larger question about how pain interrupts sleep schedules and if there's a way to address that.
There's no question that pain and sleep are inextricably intertwined. We know that pain can worsen sleep, as you're describing, and we know that poor sleep will increase pain sensitivity. So there's a well-documented bidirectional relationship between disturbed sleep and increased pain. Frankly, it sounds like a very difficult situation that the patient, that the caller rather is asking about regarding her husband. I would encourage you to work with an expert specialist team, and you should know that opioids increase central sleep apnea, which we talked about earlier.
Ellen, thank you for the call, and I wish you a good way of addressing this. We got an email from Christine in White Marsh, who says she has I have had many dreams every night for years. Does dreaming affect the quality of sleep?
Dreaming can be a sign of very good sleep. We all dream. Dreaming is natural, normal, and many would argue even necessary. Now, if the content of those dreams is chronically disturbing, in other words, if there is a nightmare component, there are effective treatment interventions for nightmares. But if the question is it okay that I'm dreaming? The answer is absolutely yes.
We're almost out of time, and I want to say to all of the people who have called whom we haven't gotten to and the emailers that I hope we can have you back again because clearly people have a lot of questions and comments about sleep. Let me just, in the minute or so we have left, share this note from Aaron, this email. When I was in college, I was never a big fan of pulling all-nighters. In fact, I never pulled an all-nighter until grad school. Even now, if I'm having trouble concentrating at work, I will spend 20 of the 30 minutes of my lunch break napping in my car, and I always feel much more refreshed and able to concentrate afterwards. For me, it almost seems like a brain reset button. Is Aaron onto something?
In healthy sleepers, naps can be wonderful, restorative, enjoyable, pleasurable. I'm all for it.
Terrific. Dr. Emerson Wickwire, he's assistant professor of psychiatry and medicine at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, director of the insomnia program at the University of Maryland Medical Center. Thank you so much for this hour.
Thank you for having me.
Lunch for our midday guests provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies with locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the Square in Canton and 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. At least 5 vacant houses in Baltimore have collapsed in recent weeks. Who's responsible? And what is the city doing to prevent more collapses? Tune in tomorrow for that. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.